Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, a weekly podcast on happiness and work culture. Hello again, it's Bruce Daisley, you're back again. This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. You can find all of the previous episodes on our website, and that's eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. I always welcome people linking in to me as well, or you can follow us on Twitter. And I did a really nice Twitter thread. That sort of was the word of 2 years ago. I did a Twitter thread over the weekend about the impact of laughter on us. And in fact, that's going to inform a future episode. So there's a few sort of pieces there, and I'm going to have an episode in a couple of weeks just talking about the impact of team rituals and the word that I've sort of become obsessed with, synchronization. So if you go to our Twitter, that's Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, you'll see that Twitter thread there. So I think that is going to be an amazing episode. Some really good episodes over the last few weeks. There was a fabulous discussion with Dan Pink last week that I hope you had the chance to catch up on. There was obviously a brilliant discussion that week before with Anita Williams-Woolley on the power of collective intelligence. And quite a few people have emailed me or linked in to me or tweeted me telling me that they did that exercise in their teams. So just a really good team exercise. If you want to get people talking about how to improve your team dynamic, how to improve your work culture, there's really simple free ways for you to do that there. So go and check out our Twitter if you're interested in that. So quite often in this podcast, we focus on sort of workplace happiness. And I focus on one thing that could improve your work. The examples are given there are good examples of that. Dan Pink talking about when to do various things. Anita Williams-Woolley talking about how you can sort of maximise your understanding and your empathy of everyone, really. And this week's episode is probably one of the most comprehensive episodes we've ever done, because it's someone who's devoted the last 5 or 6 years of his life really studying how teams work and understanding how we can learn from successful teams. It's a discussion with Daniel Coyle, who's the author of a fantastic new book called The Culture Code. This book's now out, so you can go and grab this. It came out last week. It came out on the 30th of January. So you can go and grab this book. And I have to tell you that sort of 50, 60 pages into this book, I wanted to stand and applaud, because the quality of the work is just really comprehensive. And you're going to get some really clear models of what needs to work, of the way that you can adapt your own workplace environment. I think one of the other things that comes up in our discussion is we talk about one of the other big culture books recently, which is Patty McCord's book, Powerful. And Patty was one of the early, she was actually on one of my earlier episodes. She was on episode 5 or 6. And she was talking about the sort of the Netflix culture document. And to a large extent, she's played a part in helping to shape the discussion about culture in the most of the business world over the last 10 years. You know, searching for the Netflix culture document, you'll see no shortage of links and commentary on it. But myself and Daniel Coyle talk about that here, and we talk really about what we think the substances are of it and the climate and sort of what that does. But that's not where the conversation starts and ends. Daniel gives you a very clear perspective of what you need to do. I would really said that the interview is a companion piece to the book. And, you know, if there's one thing that I would recommend you do is pick up a copy of this book. Daniel was an international bestseller with a book called The Talent Code a couple of years ago, just really trying to understand the impact of talent and how we can cultivate and develop our own talent. And he's taken that thoroughness of approach to putting this new book together. So I loved it so much, I contacted the publishers. And actually, we're running an event. So we're running a second event. Very cheap event, 25 quid if you don't want the book, 40 quid if you do want the book. And you'll see that I've tweeted about that. So if you want to hear directly from Daniel about his experience and the way that he feels that you can bring what he describes as sort of the magic of great culture, how you can bring that to your team, strongly recommend you pick up this book. And the tickets, I know there was, I tweeted it out yesterday morning, there was a whole load of interest. So move quickly on that if you're interested. So Daniel Coyle, his new book is out now. It's called The Culture Code, and I caught up with Daniel to talk about it. Here's Daniel. So Daniel, thank you so much for joining me. I'm blown away by this new book, The Culture Code. The big question I think you set about answering is why some groups add up to more than some of their parts, and that's, I guess, the cultural dividend that probably anyone who's listening to this is thinking about. So what's the answer?
That's it. I mean, and it's funny to back up, you know, and it's so good to be here with you, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me. You know, when you think about it, most groups add up to less. You know, when you look at most groups, when you really look at the sum total of talent and experience and charisma and energy, and you put people together in a group, most of them add up to a little bit less. And so I've spent the last 5 years finding groups that add up to a lot more, not a little bit, but a lot more, some of the best cultures on the planet, and was privileged enough to spend time inside Pixar and the Navy SEALs and the San Antonio Spurs basketball team and IDEO and Zappos and a bunch of other places. And there's a pattern that they share. You know, we typically think about culture as being kind of this mystical, magical, it's in their DNA. We connect it to their identity, their special identity. But in fact, when you get a bunch of humans together in a group and have them interact, there are some real certain consistent tensions that come up, and there's certain systems that are in play. And these are places that have aligned their habits with the way the science of how good culture actually is created. So it's not, what I found is that it's not magic. It's not this sort of special sauce or DNA. It's about really specific behaviors that have to do with how do you connect people? How do you get them to interact in a truthful and high candor way? And how do you get them to move together toward a purpose? And there was one story in particular that, you know, really helped unlock that early on that I tell in the book, that of course has to do with marshmallows.
It's too tempting to have had that offered to us and not hear the story. What's the marshmallow story? Tell one.
It's pretty good. I mean, it's about a contest. There was an engineer named Peter Skillman who decided to kind of investigate this question of why do certain groups produce so much more than the sum of their parts? And he did it. He had a contest. The contest was very simple. It was to build a tower out of the following materials: 20 pieces of raw spaghetti, a yard of tape, and a single marshmallow. The only rule was that the marshmallow had to go on the top. But the interesting part was the teams that he chose. He chose teams of MBAs, four-person teams, teams of CEOs, teams of lawyers, and teams of kindergartners. And he put them all in a big room. And I sort of like to picture it like they're on a big football field, right? And over here are the CEOs, and over here are the MBAs, over here the lawyers, over here are the kindergartens, and they all get to work. And all of the adult groups follow the same template. You know, they get together like any meeting, any business meeting would, right? They talk and they analyze the problem and they suggest some solutions and they hone those solutions. And it's like this perfect embodiment of human cooperation. Like, it looks lovely. It looks smooth. It looks fluent. It looks organized. It looks great. The kindergartners do not do that. Like, they just start grabbing stuff and they're shoulder to shoulder and they're interrupting each other and they're grabbing stuff out of each other's hands, and it looks like monkeys, you know, just complete chaos. And if you had to bet, you know, if you had to bet your life savings on which group would win, if you had to put it in a wheelbarrow and push it to the center of the field and guess who was going to win, most of us would not pick the kindergartners. We'd pick the CEOs or somebody else. But it turns out that we're wrong. When you do this experiment, the kindergartners build a tower. The average height is 26 inches. The CEO's average height is 20 inches. And the reason that we get it wrong is that we fundamentally misunderstand the dynamics with which groups come together. We focus on what we can see, which is smart people. We see smart, experienced people, and we think they're going to combine to be a smart, experienced group in the same way that, like, 2 + 2 = 4. But in the CEO's case, 2 + 2 = 3. 2 + 2 = 2. The kindergartners come together, 2 + 2 = 10, because we overvalue smartness and we undervalue the most important dynamic, which is safety.
I think this story blew me away when I read it, because a friend of mine had quit a job in the last 12 months to go and become a chef. and sort of learn the chefs, the skills of being in the kitchen. And she said the fastest group, all the groups are split into different age groups. The fastest group are the 19-year-olds. And the people she's with, she's in her early 30s. She said the fastest group are 19-year-olds because they tend to learn about half the speed of everyone else. And it's not for any other reason than what you describe in the book as status management. Older people and people who are more senior tend to talk more to try and manage their position in the hierarchy in the group, try and manage or demonstrate where they sit in the group. And there were so many echoes of what she said, Georgina said to me, of the work that you've done here. There's so many sort of echoes of your research. You're effectively saying that we've actually become less capable in our working environment. We find ourselves now less capable than we would be as kids. Do you want to just explain why that is?
It's our wiring. We are wired to be keenly aware of where we fit into any social order. And as those CEOs show, as your friends' experience shows, we spend a tremendous amount of unconscious and conscious energy, kind of like a secret second job of managing our status. You know, those CEOs, when they're trying to build that tower, there's actually a little whisper in the back of their mind, where do I fit in? Is it okay to say that? Like, that takes a tremendous amount of attention, energy, motivation to sort of pay attention to that. So it's our default status. We can't help it. You know, we really can't help it. This is why most groups are less than the sum of their parts. When we come together, we're devoting a huge amount of our attention and energy to wondering, where do we fit in? Now, the kindergartners succeed because there's none of that. And the 19-year-olds succeed because there's much less of that. So what this really shows is just how pervasive status management is. And because it's so pervasive, culture can't just sort of come in and hope that it goes away, because it never goes away. The cure is safety. So the good cultures flood the zone with what are called belonging cues, small cues that send a big message, which is we're connected, we're safe, we care about you, we're committed with you. That warmth that you feel in good cultures is not an accident. It's because they are purposely sending those signals to create safety. And that safety gets rid of the status management and lets a group become more than the sum of its parts. And there's all kinds of cool science around this too, because, you know, for example, there's another story I tell in the book about a company called Wipro. Now, Wipro was struggling with retention. They were a call center in India, and so they tended to lose about half of their workforce every 6 months. They did a tiny experiment where they changed orientation by just 1 hour. The 1 hour, they broke the group into two different groups. One group got the standard orientation, which was to tell the new employees all about how great Wipro was. They met a star employee. They learned about all the perks of working there. It was a Wipro-centered presentation. The other group went to a presentation that asked questions. And the questions weren't about Wipro. The questions were about the employees, the new trainees. The questions were like, what happens on your best day? What happens on your worst day? If we were on a desert island, what skills would you bring to our survival? So it was just an hour of asking the new people some questions. 7 months later, that second group was 250% more likely to still be employed at Wipro, to still be there. They had a sense of belonging. And that belonging wasn't accidental. It was delivered in those quick belonging cues. When you ask an authentic question, when you demonstrate care, when you send a signal, we share a future, you're really doing something really powerful to someone's brain. You're sending them a signal. These are your people. It's safe to connect. You can turn off that status management virus that's sort of worrying in the back of your brain, and you can connect.
There's a couple of things in the book that I found really interesting as an interesting contrast. So in the model that you've built, which is sort of first, build safety. Second, collectively share vulnerability amongst yourselves. I guess one of the things that sometimes we see that expressed as is family. And you even say in the start of your book, often high performance teams describe themselves as family, describe themselves as having this sort of family relations. Do you think that word's fair? I've been discussing it with other people with regards to sort of working cultures. And the word family and belonging is something that some people, Patty McCord, for example, from Netflix, some people feel uncomfortable with. You seem more comfortable with that sense of belonging.
Well, it's more, I think you can call it a variety of things, but the feeling, how that gets expressed can vary. You know, there's the Netflix way of presenting it, which is to say, hey, we're not a family. This is a team. The difference is when you talk about the connection they feel and the connection they behave to each other. The way they behave to each other, and when they think about the sacrifice they'd be willing to make for each other, That's the metaphor that a lot of people reach for, and the metaphor that a lot of people describe with that. Sort of interestingly, this sort of bridges into another discussion, which is there's this sort of impression that in a great culture, everyone's having tons of fun all the time. I think that goes along with this sort of family idea that we're just having a blast together. And that's not actually what goes on. I mean, there's a very deep level of engagement, but it's not sort of fun, and it's not fun and games all the time. There's a sense of fun, but it's more like a deep engagement. It's more like working on hard problems together, a deep involvement. And the feeling that people have when they're connected to a strong culture like that is often, boy, sometimes I wish I could quit, but I just can't. It's just too fascinating. You know, I'm too connected to these people. I hate it, but I love it. Kinds of emotions that come out when they're connected to that culture. You know, it's a really complex thing. To call it family is too simple and a term, but it does evoke some of the kind of push-pull and the intensity of the bond is family-like.
Yeah, and the thing that really struck me from what you said, how to cultivate that family or intense feeling, is something that you can only create authentically. So one of the things that you mentioned is that there's this survey that showed the most valuable successful cultures, and the survey was in Silicon Valley, which often just a great place to see lots of different cultures emerging very quickly. But you said it was a commitment model, and you described what the commitment model is. But effectively, that's where people are working to a shared set of values. And I sat there and I thought, yeah, you'd struggle to find any company in Silicon Valley that doesn't espouse shared values. There'll be very different experiences at those different companies, though. How do you ensure that those shared values actually authentically work rather than sort of just look like they're going through the motions of shared values?
Yeah, I know. That's where you really get – it's tricky because everyone's talking this language right now. Everyone wants to present as having that sort of culture. And I think there's a few indicators that distinguish kind of the pretend shallow cultures. Let's make the world a better place and play foosball together with a deeper, more intense culture that actually has that authenticity that you're talking about. And one is the leadership, the shadow of leadership, it's called. The behaviors of the leader end up really driving the culture to a tremendous degree. And so when you have got a leader whose behaviors reflect these on a deep, deep level in a consistent way, then you've got a shot. That was one thing that I saw at all of the cultures that I visited. Their leaders were absolutely the embodiment of that culture, of cultures of care. One example, I guess, I saw with the San Antonio Spurs, Greg Popovich. The care that he takes with each interaction, with each player, is the purest distillation of that culture. So when you've got the leaders, the other thing that you see in a strong culture like that is that you don't see any bad apples. The absence of bad apples, the zero tolerance for bad apples, the ferocity with which they defend their culture against jerks is typically very clear, explicit, and strong. So you sort of at once, between those two indicators, a leader whose every behavior sort of captures and models that, and a zero tolerance for even the most brilliant jerk, because they want to defend that culture as much as possible. And I guess a third indicator would be that if you pay attention to the way people treat each other, typically the way they treat each other in a great culture is the highest priority. They'll prioritize each other's relationships over other pressing, you know, pressing commitments. So the way that they treat each other, if you pay attention to that, that ends up being a third sort of indicator that, yes, this is something that might go beyond the sort of surface appearance of good culture and actually goes deep into the behavior. But the other thing I would just add to that, as long as we're talking about this too, is that, you know, all these cultures struggle. There's no such thing as a perfect culture out there. They all struggle with things the same reason that, you know, cultural fitness is the same thing as fitness for you and me. You know, it's not easy to sort of eat right and keep your mind sharp and exercise. And good cultures are the same way. They need to maintain their fitness, and they will have bad moments, and they will have very real struggles, and they will be terrified of certain things happening. But that's just part of putting a group together and part of being a culture.
So we touched on it briefly before. I read your book back to back with Patty McCord's book. Patty was one of the instigators of the Netflix culture documentary. He talked about it there. Not only does Patty overtly say that work isn't a family, but they almost deliberately go against your notion of building safety by saying, look, if you're not delivering here, we're going to fire you. And my take is, when I see that, I question the evidence for their approach, whether it was just one or two genius inventions, and that's made their success rather than their culture. What's your take on something like that?
Yeah, it can, those things can coexist. I would say it's not safety does not mean a complete military bunker from which no one can be taken out. It's not perfect safety. On every sports team, on every military team, there's a chance of someone getting cut, of someone getting demoted. And that sort of exists on a slightly different level, I guess. It's there. It's not part of the, I don't know, the almost daily consciousness. I think good places try, their culture's more of kind of using the interactions to create energy in a positive way rather than using fear. Those aren't cultures of fear typically that are really good. And when you find a culture of great fear, it can be effective for a while. Like it's a decent lever, but in the long run, it sort of is a volatile fuel that sort of burns itself out. These places that I saw, even when someone was let go or when someone was fired or when someone moved on, there was the bonds of the group always sort of stayed strong. I mean, there still was a sense of team and connection because of the safety, because of the vulnerability they shared, because of the purpose that they shared. They had built that bond.
Is it then, and I'm trying to interpret this, I know that the metaphor of family isn't the right one, but is it like this fraternal or sorority thing where teams that seem to work really well, you talked about military teams, you talked about sporting teams, there's this like certain servant leadership amongst the leaders that seems to be characteristic in all those teams. And you talked about the sports coach who's sort of picking up litter every day, going around picking up trash. So this servant leadership, this sort of leadership without ego, seems to be really common. I wonder if that's what forges the bond between the members of the team, that you've got this servant leadership that then permits the relationship between the team members. Is there anything in that at all?
Well, the leaders that I saw were very good at, you know, we have kind of an authoritarian part of our brains, right? That it wants to immediately fall into a hierarchy. And most of these leaders, as you mentioned, go out of their way to kind of throw a bug into that software. They constantly are being vulnerable with the team. They constantly are sort of confessing their own shortcomings and their own weaknesses to try to create what would be called a vulnerability loop when two people share the truth. And so the leaders are the ones who set that tone. There tends to be, it varies by group. Each group is different. Some groups, the leader is a little bit separate. Other groups, the leader is right in there all the time. But there is always that sense of we need to tell the truth. We need to open up to each other. And the leader is the one who's usually instigating that exchange. As one of the Navy SEAL commanders told me, I screwed that up is the most important four words that any leader can say, because it allows other people to share their screw ups. It allows people. And even more sort of fascinatingly, when you sort of pull the camera way back and look at each of these groups as an organism, like as a cellular organism with all these pieces moving together, they move in certain ways. And one of the ways in which they move that creates vulnerability is they constantly circle up and tell each other the truth. You know, which is really hard to do. It's awkward. It's painful. It's embarrassing at times, but almost like an athlete develops workout habits, these cultures develop habits where at Pixar, it's called the brain trust.
Okay, I was going to ask you about the brain trust now, actually. What an incredible book by Ed Catmull in the first instance. But the brain trust really is actually not that welcoming, is it? It's sort of not a warm, happy thing. Do you want to talk about the role that the Brain Trust plays at Pixar?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, every movie goes through several years of development, and every few months they get together, they watch the latest draft of the movie. And this is a group of veteran Pixar storytellers, sort of the best storytelling minds in the company. And they watch the movie and they circle up and then they basically tear it apart. I mean, it's not pretty. It's not fun. The director's sitting there watching this thing that he's labored over for months and sometimes years. And people will simply say things like, I don't like that character. I don't think that plot's working. And it's very blunt. And the one rule of the Brain Trust is you're not allowed to offer a solution. And the reason that that rule exists is because if one of these powerful people in the Brain Trust offered a solution, the director would just do it and sort of give over authority and give over control of the project in that way to that person who made the suggestion. So all they're allowed to do is point out flaws. So it makes it even more uncomfortable and difficult. And there's tons of silence and there's tons of awkwardness. And it's the best thing that that group does, because that shows the path forward. That helps the director. It's really hard to build a movie. There's a lot of moving parts. This helps it more than anything else. Ed Catmull, the president of Pixar, said it's the single most important thing that happens here. And he's right, because it is mutual vulnerability. It shows the way because they're honestly confronting their weakness.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, the thing that really strikes me when you're going through all of this is if you're going to have that trust, if you're going to build safety and then allow people to feel vulnerability, and there's the leaders and, like you say, there's the Brain Trust, everyone's sharing vulnerability. It feels like there's sort of a finite limit to how big a team that shares vulnerability can be, though. Effectively, if you're going to make sure that sort of companies work well, if you're going to create successful teams within companies, then you've got to find a way to connect people in those teams. Do you have any perspective? You don't really talk about team size, but do you have any perspective on how big teams can be or how small teams need to be to adapt this culture code?
Yeah, I think when you get into certain teams, you have to, you know, I'm a believer in the two pizza rule, the Bezos. Any team that's bigger than can be fed with two pizzas is possibly too big. And so the sort of level of vulnerability that you'll have inside those smaller teams is order of magnitude higher than you'll get outside of those teams and bigger. So what you end up seeing is sort of a landscape, larger landscape of some safety with this intensely shared vulnerability, truth telling, face to face, person to person inside those smaller teams to drive accurate behavior, to help uncover what weaknesses really are. So yes, you're constantly sort of balancing those things, creating safety so that you can have vulnerability. And in the largest sense, you know, I think we tend to think about cultural problems in a little bit of the wrong way. You know, every culture has got the set of issues. Every culture has got these little, I don't know, disorders, diseases, whatever you want to call it. But those aren't really problems. You know, those are biological requirements. You're navigating tensions that are part of being a group of human beings together. And those tensions will always revolve around, you know, do we feel connected? that'll be one big point of tension. Are we really connected? Are we really telling each other the truth is the other one. And the other one is, what's our purpose? You know, where are we headed? So the idea that these problems are kind of, more than just sort of systemic, can sometimes lead you to a false path. So treating them like, hey, this is the price of doing business. This is like an athlete training. The leaders that you see in these places tend to be, they're almost like communication athletes. You know, they're compelled. They take a sort of craft person-like approach to it, and they're very disciplined about it. And so that sort of model where you've got kind of, it's almost an athletic model for building culture ends up being, I think, a little more helpful than thinking, oh, we have these problems.
One of the things I scribbled down was that you made reference to something saying the most successful projects were driven by what you describe as clusters of high communicators. And I guess that's what you're saying there. These singular communicators generally are the dynamos, the drivers for good culture. In fact, one of the things you talk about is how energy is contagious. There's a contagion of energy from strong leaders.
That's right. You know, you have these people who are able to, there's actually a series of fascinating experiments done by a guy at MIT named Sandy Pentland.
Yeah, we had him on the show.
No kidding. Oh, he's
what a legend.
He probably talked about these charismatic connectors. You see them on his map moving and connecting and bringing that knowledge back and bringing that energy back. And we're in such a fascinating age with his work to be able to say, look, this isn't just a feeling. Here's the experiment. Here's how many collisions we had. Here's what those collisions led to. This idea that when you take a God's eye view of a successful group, they all kind of look the same, you know, that they're all having these short, quick conversations, high energy conversations. They're circulating. Everyone's talking to everybody. You know, that feeling you have when you walk into a great culture, whether it's a great restaurant or a great school or a great business, that feeling is always the same.
Yeah, but don't you think electronic communication is killing this? I know in the book you talked to Ben Wabbat, and Ben followed on Sandy Pentland's work, and we chatted to Ben on the show a few weeks ago. All of it seemed to be sort of reminding you the magic, the singular sort of power of face-to-face communication and how we can create that kinetic energy. And for me, sort of the growing burden of meetings and emails upon people seemed to be silently bulldozing that magic. Do you agree on that? What's your take on the impact of email?
I agree 1,000% with you. Face-to-face is the original software. It works extraordinarily well. The research will show that if you make a request, if I were to make a request to you face to face, it's 34 times more likely that you would respond to it than if I sent you an email. So, by that measure, spending time together is 34 times more effective than spending time communicating digitally. So, yes, there is an amazing tension in the workplace right now between balancing these things, and it seems like we are kind of bulldozing a lot of old-fashioned, better face-to-face technology for the sake of sort of swift, less meaningful communications. And we've seen that move, maybe the pendulum is moving a bit. You know, there has been several large companies who have recently said, look, we're putting a priority on face-to-face communication. We're building workplaces that will help prioritize that. And we really do have a deep understanding that the magic really does happen when two people are in the same space.
Yeah, fascinating. I do hope that people in power, the ones who realize this, I fully agree. I'll just finish on one question, Daniel. Actually, it was the footnote really at the end of the book. I was really moved by the story you gave of how, having spent time with all these teams and all these coaching environments, you took on the task of coaching a school writing team. I'd be thrilled if you just talked through your experience of that.
Oh, it was cool. You know, I was spending time, you know, going around the planet, you know, with all of these remarkable teams, and there was a team down the street. You know, my kids go to a school down the street, and they have a writing competition where they write short stories, and they get judged. You give a prompt, you have a short amount of time, and so I spent the year kind of applying some of these ideas to that group to see if we could improve the culture and the cohesion and the performance of that group. Now, originally, I set out coaching like any coach would. You know, I stood up at the front. I told them what to do. I kind of evaluated them. After I got kind of immersed in a lot of these theories of culture, I ended up taking a very different approach, kind of going from the side, trying to generate conversations, connect, trying to create a sense of safety. I was very purposely vulnerable with them, showing them my work and showing how many crossouts there were and how badly I struggled to finish certain stories. And getting them to talk and trying to connect into their world, and gradually sort of flooding the zone with a lot of really clear signals of safety, of shared vulnerability, and a lot of sort of catchphrases. You know, we see that with a lot of leadership. I tried to kind of flood the zone with these sort of GPSs that would help them solve problems, just like I had seen so many groups do. And it was really cool, because what we saw was, you know, some on kind of the performance level, you know, huge increase in performance. The team did, you know, sensationally well. But even more kind of inspiring was the way it brought out the kids, where they really brought their whole selves to class and really connected as a team and a family, to use that word, in a way that I hadn't expected. So it was a good combination of saying, look, a nice little test drive of some of these ideas to say, hey, you know, and everybody at the end was saying, oh, this just is like magic. What a magical team. You know, we're still kind of this legendary team. And I want to sort of, you know, on the one hand, I love that. On the other hand, it's sort of frustrating, because I'm saying, look, it's not magic. It's just behavior. It's not magic any more than if we had, you know, really practiced at a video game or at a golf game or anything else, but we just did. We followed best practices. Culture is not magic. It's a set of behaviors. And if you know the behaviors, you can create the magic.
I love that story. And hearing you retell it, I'm sort of loving it again. Actually, more than anything, it makes you realize, sort of irrespective of your own work situation, you can have an impact on people who you sort of, like you say, down the street, or, you know, you are in your social circle. You can use these things, whether it's in your job, whether it's in your life. Actually, these things can have an impact on everyone around you and the happiness of people around you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're built in a way that every interaction matters, you know, which is kind of a, you know, corny thing to say, every interaction matters. Well, in fact, that's the way human beings are built. Every interaction really does matter to us. We react to all of them. So if you pay attention and maximize those in ways and align yourself with the ways that create cohesion, you can really make them matter a lot.
Like I say, if you're interested in attending an event with Daniel Coyle that's at the start of March, you can go to my Twitter, which is Eat Sleep Work Repeat. Search for Eat Sleep Work Repeat. You'll see that. Or you can see it on my own Twitter, but in amongst pop music and opinions on politics. So you might not want to delve too deeply into there. But either way, you can find it. Always welcome people linking into me and contacting me. And you can see all of the stuff if you're interested on the website. There's a full transcript of today's episode with Daniel Coyle on the website, and that's eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. I can't tell you how much I love all of your feedback. It's really good to hear what you think I've done well and what you think I've done badly. And we've got some great episodes coming up. I'm trying to put these episodes together before I go away, but this a fantastic episode about sort of workplace changes that we can all do that's coming up. Some fantastic contributors there. Then there's an episode about workplace rituals and synchronization, and I think you're going to find that fabulous. So some really good stuff coming up. Do get in touch. Speak to you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.